library. I will let each person on the panel introduce themselves, and we have some questions we will be answering, but we also encourage the audience to join in very much in discussion.
Which one to start?
That's why the pronunciation is not good anyway. But I did learn some stuff.
Then do I have to
choose? Oh, sorry.
So we're just going to each give big 5 minutes of views of who we are, what we do, and what our perspectives are on preserving the people. Can you hear me now?
Awesome.
There are definitely some challenges to being a poker.
You get
microphones never at my level. I don't fit well on an airplane coming down here from the East Coast. I'm Matt Weber. I'm at Rutgers University. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Communication. Vertically challenged the other way. So I'm a communication researcher. This is going to be a really quick snapshot of what my perspective is on news archives. So I'm going to talk really briefly about web archives and the news media and the role that I see these two different areas of research playing in concert with one another. I came into academia actually from the news media industry. I worked at Tribune Corp for a number of years. On the business side, I worked as a reporter for the Waterloo Courier out of Waterloo, Iowa, covering politics in D.C. So I've seen the business side. The newsroom didn't look quite like this. In fact, when I was working in Waterloo, I was working ad hoc on my own. This is the New York Times newsroom, 1942. News today is dramatically different. Part of why I came into the academic world was really wanted to explore some in-depth questions regarding the way in which news media is transforming, what the modern structure of the news media industry was and is. Part of the challenge with digital content, digital-only content, is that we're increasingly seeing digital-only content with no offline service. So the only representation we have of news and news organizations online is that digital format. And yet, at the same time, it's becoming increasingly hard to locate that digital content, that digital record of news, unless you're looking at it in the now, unless you're looking at it today, online, as it is. And I experienced, which was a researcher, wanting to study the way in which the industry was changing, wanting to be able to look back in time at the way in which online news was developing. About a decade ago, when I started that work, I very quickly realized that there was no large-scale online repository of archived news. I couldn't look back in time. I was very lucky to meet some folks from the Internet Archive about 10 years ago who were amassing a lot of this content as well. We've got some of it. Maybe you can do something with it. Maybe we can start to build some research around this. And that's where I began my research foray into working with archived web content. As I started to develop that research agenda, I started to see research around online news and online news archives evolving and emerging in a number of different ways. Two examples that I want to point to. The first is Occupy Wall Street, which really came to the forefront of our attention in 2011-2012. This is one of the first examples that we see in modern times of a news story that existed primarily in the online space. Yes, there were protests offline, but where we saw a lot of the attention focused was around online coverage and online representation of this event, and also reported about online. So the news was online, the event existed online. It was the first time we really saw coming together of these two spaces, the event and the coverage, in the online space, in a place where we could actually see the content and look back and see the content today. There's a very good archive around the Occupy Wall Street movement. More broadly, I personally see a need, a growing need, to archive and store content around local news. And one of the areas where I'll highlight the need for local news is with regards to politics and public democracy. very out of topic, given the times that we're living in this month. Local news for me is at the forefront of ongoing discussions regarding the need for archiving local news content because of the importance of local news in encouraging public debate and public democracy. We know that when there is a rich and vibrant local news environment, we as individuals are more likely to become involved in public debate and public discussion regarding politics and regarding civic society. And yet, where we see the fewest efforts regarding preserving online content is around local news. And so just to close, I'll say, working on a project right now funded by the Democracy Fund to create a very small snapshot, a very small archive of archive content of local news websites based on a random sample of 100 communities, populations between 50 and 150,000 sample from the U.S. Census, begin exploring ways in which we can build local news archives and begin to demonstrate some of the research utility of local news archives. And with that, I'll hand things over to the other two co-presenters for their directions. Thank you.
Three co-presenters.
Next, we'll have Laura Rubel.
Hi. I don't have slides, so I think I'll sit at the table here. I'm in George Washington University Libraries in the Scholarly Technology Group, and I'm speaking as someone who works in a university library, supporting the research and teaching and learning of our students and faculty, and as well as the broader community that UW serves. I'm involved in a project called Social Feed Manager, which is open source software that allows researchers and archivists and librarians to create collections of social media from several social media platforms, Twitter, Tumblr, Flickr, and also CyanWeibo. We developed Social Feed Manager initially in 2012 to help our faculty and grad students in the School of Media and Public Affairs study how journalists and news organizations use Twitter. Kimberly Gross is a faculty member there. Her students were doing some work with the Pew Research Center on Journalism and Media, examining suites of news outlets and professional journalists at the time. And they had a very manual sort of workflow for creating that data set. So my colleague at the time, Dan Chudnoff, created a prototype tool to help them collect in a programmatic way the data from Twitter that they needed for their research. Incidentally, their core findings were that journalists were not using Twitter to solicit information or converse with an audience, but to direct readers back to their main news site. This was research that was done in 2011, 2012, and they're now updating that with the newer version of Social Feed Manager, so I'm curious to see if things have changed. So that work has grown into a service of the library, where we've collected tweets and other social media for faculty and for students from a range of disciplines across the university. And within the library and the archives itself, we've done some collecting by a collecting of Twitter accounts by university offices on campus and other groups on campus. And we've also been doing some proactive collecting of social media by news outlets and also by accounts that we expect to be of interest to study in the future, such as political candidates. We're doing a lot of collecting around the current presidential election in particular. We have a grant now from the National Historic Publications and Records Commission, which is part of the National Archives, to further develop Social Feed Manager over the next year. And towards that end, we're placing a particular focus on documenting the collecting activity itself. So if you're an archivist, you might call it provenance. If you're a researcher, it might fall under the heading of data documentation. So how was that collection created? Why was it created? When did the collecting start? And when did it stop? When did you add particular handles? All towards having a lot of the metadata around a particular data set that would support its use in the future. But we're really learning as we're going along. This is a very changing area, and there are a lot of great projects in this space that we're hoping to learn from as well.
All right, Chris.
So speaking of collaborating on, my name is Chris Freeman. I'm an associate university librarian at Washington University in St. Louis, another Washington University guest. You might have seen us at the last Sunday presidential debate. As I mentioned, I'm an associate university librarian. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Freeland, and I posted links that I'm going to talk about on my Twitter feed for this morning.
I'm here representing a project called Documenting the Now. This is a two-year collaborative project funded by the Mellon Foundation. It's a collaboration between Washington University, with myself as one of the co-PIs, also Burgess Jewell, who's at the University Archivist at the UC of Riverside, and Ed Summers, who's a lead technologist at the University of Maryland, at the Maryland Institute for Technology and Humanities. Also on our team is Dan Chudnoff, who is a developer working in the space of social media archiving. The purpose of the Documenting the Now project is to create a facility, a platform, for the capture, analysis, and archiving of social media content, specifically looking at Twitter. This project grows from two parallel efforts that started in 2012 as a result of Michael Brown's shooting in Ferguson, Missouri on August 9th, 2012. At Washington University, we felt compelled to do something for the community. What could we do as libraries and archives to respond to the actions, the activities that were happening in our neighborhood, to our communities, to our neighbors? We built Documenting Ferguson, which is a participatory archive to gather information, to gather media, videos, other content that people would contribute to our archive about what was happening on the ground, what was happening during those protests, what was happening in our community. At the same time, Burgess and Ed were having conversations at SAA, the Society for American Archivists, at the same time of right at the moment of Michael Brown's death. And the conference was talking about sort of the side chatter along in the hall of the conference was what can we as memory institutions do to gather these data and how can we hold on to them so that the story can persist. So Ed, who's a technologist who started working in Twitter data previously with as well as the Library of Congress, fired up a process called TWARC, which is a Twitter archive based off of the TWARC, the web archive of standard that has been developed by Internet Archive and others, and gathered 14 million tweets in about 2 weeks following the hashtag of Ferguson. And Ed and Burgess, both archivists and librarians, were talking at that conference about how could we make this a facility, how could we make this more of a platform for others to use. Ed was able to do this because he's a technologist and could sort of build the infrastructure that was needed. But everyone understood that not everyone has those capabilities. And so what we wanted to do is try to build this platform for others for reuse, for capturing of data and analysis of data. We've assembled an advisory board, members of which are here today. We've had really interesting conversations at our August meeting in St. Louis. And I posted a link to that on Twitter, and I would encourage anyone who's interested in the topics of activism and the ethics of both activism as well as archiving to follow those. There are four videos online that are fascinating. The one in particular is our second panel was a student activist from Washington University and from the community, and their stories are just raw and heartfelt, and really I think should be sort of required viewing for archivists into what did it mean to run a social media archive and what are the issues around the ethics of gathering this data. And I'll be talking more in the next questions about those issues around ethics. That's just one thing that Laura and I were talking before the session started. How do we differentiate Social Feed Manager and Documenting the Now? And I think one of the things, and we can talk about this more, is the foremost in our project is this issue of ethics and what does it mean to gather these data and what's our responsibility as memory organizations in responsible collecting and use of those data.
Thank you. And my name is Anna Kramer. I manage the digital newspaper unit at the University of North Texas Libraries. In this work, I oversee an NEH grant for the National Digital Newspaper Program. We've been awarded for four cycles on that. But we also have negotiated with the Texas Press Association to digitally preserve the PDFs that are harvested for clipping service by the Press Association, which has almost 300 member publishers. Texas is unusual in that most of its news is what I've heard would be called hyper-local, very rural news, continually published. These are born digital PDFs, and we are able to digitally preserve them and create access to them via the Portal to Texas History, which is an access and preservation repository, We now house approximately 5 million pages, or we're approaching very close to 5 million pages of digital newspapers. We also manage the Gateway to Oklahoma History, where we digitally preserve Oklahoma newspapers, oddly enough. And we will get to our questions now. Now, how about we start? What is new? And what needs to be archived and why?
I think the first question here, and I don't have a good answer on this, is what is news? It's hopefully something that you all can find some insight on as well, because I think that definition that you have is unique to each of us. We each have our own perspective on what news is today, and that's critical to understanding what needs to be archived. I think we need to be creating a record of news events as they are recorded online today. I think that often means recording and archiving content from mainstream news websites, first and foremost. But I think that also means that we need to be capturing as much of the social news and social representation of news that occurs online as we can. Often that's a fragmented and diverse sample of information and resources, but I think it's an important record of the society that we're living in today. In short, I think we need to tackle these questions and understand what we do news as today, in part because we're no longer producing the hard copies of news that we were a decade ago or 2 decades ago. Yes, we do have print newspapers still. Print is not dead. I don't think print is going to be dead for quite some time. But online representation of news is an increasingly important part of this conversation and one that we need to be capturing. So I'll leave it as we need to define news and putting out more questions than I'm answering. But hopefully that will give us something to talk about in a few minutes.
I just want to underscore the point that Matt just made. There are a lot of perspectives on what news is, and we were noticing on our panel that we don't have anybody from a news organization actually on this panel, and that is a perspective that we're hoping to hear about in the discussion as well, because that's an important aspect of this conversation. I can only speak to my experience working in a library and helping researchers and students access news at some point after it was published. It might be 50 years in the case of, say, our student newspaper, or a year ago in the case of social media posts by a political candidate. Social media definitely blurs or enlarges what we might conceive of as news. One of our political science faculty, Danny Hayes, has examined how political candidates in the recent midterm House elections communicate via social media. And for most of the campaigns that they analyzed, Twitter was how candidates were communicating with the news outlets. So does that make it news itself? Is the conversation that journalists and news organizations participate in, is that news itself? And if that's the case, what sort of tools do we need to have to archive that aspect as well? You could argue that social media is a form of crowdsourced news, and if so, what does it mean to archive the news produced by private citizens in a way? And I think that's something I think we'll be able to speak to with us as well.
So full disclosure, I'm a biologist by training. I'm a recovering software developer, and I'm currently an administrator in a library. So I feel somewhat ill-equipped to discuss what is news, but I am a consumer of news. I think we all are. When I think about what is news and the issues that my project, the Documenting the Now, is working with, I think about the way that Twitter was used in those moments, in those days, and those weeks after Michael Brown's death. Twitter was the place to go and find information about what was happening immediately, not only in the not only in St. Louis, but also around the nation and around the world. Twitter was used as a primary source of information to talk about where the protests were happening, who was involved, where you could go for information, where you could go for assistance. It was more information was more widely available via Twitter than it was through our local news outlets. So the nature of the protest in and around St. Louis was that they didn't just happen in Ferguson, they happened across the city of St. Louis. And I live in a neighborhood where there were protests. And one night I was sitting and hearing helicopters hovering around my neighborhood and hearing chants and protests. I could hear that from five blocks away. I didn't know what was happening. I turned on the local news, nothing. Turned on the radio, nothing. Went to Twitter and immediately found out that there was a Black Lives Matter protest that was happening five blocks away from my house. That was fascinating. That, to me, was the moment where I said, this is where news is happening. This is the channel that I have to follow. I didn't, we did pay attention to what was happening in the news and to the way that the story was being covered in the news. And it was different from the way that it was being covered on Twitter. Twitter was first-hand accounts. It was people on the ground. It was happening from the students, from the community members, from people all over the world. We're coming to St. Louis. We're coming to Ferguson. And so that was, it was incredibly important, I think, in many ways, for people to tell their own story and also to have alternate voices in the mix so that it wasn't just what was happening from a trained journalist. Not, of course, nothing wrong with trained journalists, and great respect. There were journalists who were present during the protest, but again, their cycle was such that the writing and the editorial process for what they were writing was on a delay. So, you know, an hours-long delay, whereas what was happening with Twitter was happening in the moment, and we were reading about it in the moment. So as to why we should, why should we archive these data, again, I think about the data set from the Ferguson protest, and this is a research data set, and that was one of the reasons why Washington University was interested in this project. What can we gather and learn from that mass of data, from those 14 million tweets and ongoing? You should know that there are millions more tweets now still using the hashtag of Ferguson. The hashtag of Ferguson is still very much alive on Twitter. I would encourage you to go and take a look. But it gives us some insight into how people organize, what language were people using about the protest and using about one another and about our communities. And I think that because social media can be looked at as fleeting, that those data can vanish almost without regard, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to archive those data and try to commit them into a memory organization, into an archive, so that they can be used and reflected on for generations to come.
And my answer on this question is, I've been thinking about the archival question, archival scope, archival selection, curation, determination. So I would add the subject, I would make very clear the subject of who, by whom does it need to be archived? Why is somebody making a clear decision and archived is an action that somebody's committing? I manage a huge newspaper, digital newspaper program. We have a lot of data and we are now dealing with what do we archive next? What do we do as we're still grappling with communities whose newspapers have never been microfilmed even. There is no surrogate that researchers can work with in these very rural communities or in front, this hyper-local area. And we are now concerned with also how are we representing and preserving the populace right now creating digital content, creating digital news. And it's very important, I think, our keynote speaker, this merging of technological infrastructure with archival theory is tremendously important. I'm so glad you asked that question because that's something that we grapple with daily at UNT Libraries because we do have a fabulous infrastructure. And in a way, it's a bit of triage for us. So now the issue and part of why Dodging the Memory holds this is who's going to take this on? This is a burden that we have to take on. And we actually need to make plans for what institution needs to be doing what. Is it a corporate institution? Is it a cultural memory institution? And those also need to be addressed because we could all say we're going to preserve everything, but again, you can't save everything. Somebody has to curate it. And then the other question is how do we curate it to be represented for future generations? And Laura, I will give you my next question.
Thank you.
I work on a software project, but I think many of the primary barriers and challenges are not technical necessarily. I think I'll highlight one in particular that piggybacks on a lot of what Anna was just saying about what an organization can do or what organizations should do. And that is sort of how do we build the local expertise but the organizational commitment in terms of staffing to engage in this work. Very few institutions make this kind of web archiving, digital archiving work a full-time position. And yet there's no shortage of work, as you said. Tools and software can definitely help reduce that burden and make it more manageable, but the reality is that still most libraries and archives, as well as news organizations, are staffed very similarly. And these organizations, we all have a primary constituency that we have to attend to, like for our own survival. So our involvement in web archiving and news archiving has to have some roots in the needs of our community to have any sort of buy-in and support and a sort of long-term commitment to sustaining these kinds of archives. No single institution can do this work alone. So I think like we're here today because we believe like there's some value in collaboration and finding opportunities for partnership. But even participating and supporting those efforts requires staff time and commitment from our organization.
So that issue of barriers, I would agree with everything the board said. Looking at these barriers broadly, thinking specifically about the project that I represent, we have two main barriers. There are many others, but two of the barriers that we wrestle with probably the most. The first being the terms of service of the platforms that are used for communicating these data. So Twitter's terms of service are somewhat in opposition to archivists and to those of us in the room who are interested in holding onto those data over the long term. Twitter has a business model that allows us to license or to rent or lease the data. We don't get to own it, we just get to use it for a period of time. Whereas those of us who work in libraries and archives, we want to own the data. We want to have a copy of it to use in perpetuity. So there's a tension that exists between commercial use and nonprofit use of these data and the terms of service of those platforms that we publish on, that all of us, many of us, are publishing on a regular basis. We should all know we don't own our data in Twitter. Twitter owns our data. We are authors of those data. We own the intellectual property. But I can't tell someone you can't archive my data. I can't tell someone you can't download a copy of this data. Twitter, as a corporation, helps in that conversation, helps, if you will. A second, I should mention, I think that Twitter does great good, and this particular issue about the commercialization of data and the terms of service are ones that we are hopefully working with Twitter specifically about. They're aware of the project. As I mentioned, there's a little bit of a disconnect between the business models, but we're working this out. There's still ways that those of us in libraries and archives can gather these data and persist them down into our repositories. The second issue that I see as a barrier are these ethical concerns about the gathering of the data and the use of the data over time. So, again, on that, the panel that I previously mentioned by the student activists, their concerns were about identification, about loss of jobs because of their activities, because of their participation in the protests. They were concerned about retribution, about blowback, from what it meant for them to be part of this movement, for what it meant for them to be on the ground and tweeting from in the moment, and then of becoming targets for again, as I mentioned, loss of jobs or similar issues. As libraries and archives, we have to think about what does it mean for us then to archive these data? Do we need, what are our responsibilities as content holders? Do we need to let people know that their content is being included into this archive? Do we need to let people know, send them back a message to say, we're planning to bring your data into a data set that we're going to archive at Washington University Libraries or at other libraries? Do we need to give them a way to opt out? These are public data. One thing I should mention, we're only grabbing public data. We're not grabbing private information. This is only stuff that has been published publicly. So if you look just a legal reading, We have, everyone has access to gather these data, but do we have an ethical responsibility to do more? Thinking then about that opt-in or opt-out, then are there ways then of anonymizing the contribution? Are there ways of redacting the information in some way? Those are the questions that we're wrangling with. What are our responsibilities as holders of these data? What do we need to do for the people who contributed to this repository without knowing they were doing it?
Thank you. In my work, we have a very clear role of preserving community identity through the news. And while my work is mainly with Texas publishers and Texas newspapers, I've had to communicate to both public libraries and publishers very often. And I say public libraries because they hold most of the newspaper lines of newspapers. But I have to communicate to publishers the need to respect the responsibility that they have to make accessible to future generations content that they just created last year or last week, information that one day will be researched and does need to be accessible. We are about to end 2015, and I'm greatly looking forward to seeing the PDF collection that we harvest from the Press Association covering this election, for instance. But right now, very little of it is going to be available because we don't have permission necessarily from publishers. The larger newspapers owned by large corporations are the ones that we really are not allowed to make accessible. We can't usually preserve those. Smaller newspapers owned by family publishers or individual publishers in rural communities are very easy to make available. Publishers are very excited because we are able to get grants and freely archive their data for them. It's fortunate not to. But the work is basically the community role. We have a lot of underserved communities, their newspapers, because they know that they want to create that voice for future generations, and we receive PDF editions from them very quickly. The news that they create on their websites, they ask about comments. Are we going to do anything with comments? This is a question we wrestle with the Web 2.0 comments and feedback from users. But it's mainly permissions that we deal with all the time, and negotiating those and convincing publishers that they can't necessarily monetize the content. It might not. A corporation might have it and create access to it, but that doesn't mean that it will always be accessible to future generations, or that that corporation will exist in 2 years, or 10 years, or 15 years. And I think it's very dangerous to not communicate to our copyright owners the need to consider preserving more than their own institution rather than corporation. It's very difficult to do that.
So I was going to start by saying that I see a real dichotomy between a balance that needs to be struck between social good and the business argument for preserving news. And what Anna was just saying was making me think a little bit more about that. I think there is an argument to be made on the business side when you're looking at large publishers of news and large publishers of information such as Twitter, that there's a social good that's served by preserving content and donating this content in some way to a memory institution. On the other hand, there has to be a business argument. I don't think you're ever at scale going to convince for-profit news media institutions to just generously donate their content in some way, shape, or form to a memory institution. These are businesses. They're paying salaries, they're funding the technology, they're funding payroll. And so I think part of our challenge as scholars and as librarians working in the space is that we need to have a stake in that conversation. We need to be talking and thinking about what the business side of this is. I get yelled at when I talk about that at academic conferences, and I'm happy to take that on today, but as much as there is an argument for social good, I think we also do need to take a stake in the business argument. Now, that being said, the social argument is equally important and is something that we should keep beating the drum for, but we need to look at both sides of the coin. Take the newspaper industry and look at what they've gone through in the past decade. And they've seen their advertising revenues drop by a tenth, if not more, as they've shifted from selling online print advertising to online advertising. The business picture can't be ignored here. So I think that is one of the biggest barriers that we're facing broadly in preserving news and preserving in our type of news information.
Okay.
the opportunities that reveal themselves in preserving news. I think first and foremost, there's an opportunity for collaboration here and opening a dialogue from software developers to administrators to journalists about what does it mean to preserve news and what are our responsibilities in doing so. Laura and I work on similar projects that had a similar origin, yet we never met. So bringing us together in this kind of a forum is valuable, and it's valuable to bring together all of us into these rooms, not just this room, but the room that many of us gather in, to share our stories and to talk about our projects and to find out where there are commonalities and where there are differences and how we can build upon one of each other's work, which I think is what Laura and I were agreeing with happening, that we have, again, these similar origins where our projects are taking different paths. And we are in collaboration, not competition, right? That's what we were saying at breakfast. I think, too, that in the case of my project, there's an opportunity to have a dialogue about the role of social media in social justice and the role of social media in society. And also, this is sort of a technical thing for the librarians that are for this in the room and listening in. But it's to think about what does it mean for us to archive new and different media types. It's a non-trivial issue to gather 14 million tweets and to persist them into a repository and to think about how we use those data, how do we call them up, how do we analyze them, how do we read across them over time, not just today, but in 10 or 15 years. And finally, I think that there's an opportunity for us to learn about ourselves and about each other in looking at the news cycle and looking at the information, again, on Twitter about what was happening in my neighborhood, what was happening in my community, and what was happening across the world and across the nation. And, you know, unfortunately, Michael Brown's death and the Ferguson hashtag was just the start of an unfortunate long line of cop-involved, police-involved shootings and deaths. And I think that the long history that we have through this Twitter archive, through this Twitter conversation, helps us learn about one another, and I think that's important.
Part of what we've done at UNT Libraries with the digital libraries area to address issues of the archival curation and scope, we performed a self-audit using the Trusted Digital Repository Checklist, and wrote quite a few policies, particularly a collection scope policy, that has helped us develop for what we will focus on in the digital library in terms of news preservation and other preservation, all digital, of course. And that has really produced a good, sustainable document that will allow us to keep in mind the goals that we have established. There are certain rules that we just follow now because they're codified in these policies. That was one excellent opportunity that we took because our infrastructure is very strong and we know we can only do so much with how many resources we have. The other opportunities we've had are collaborating. We have, I think, most of the UNT Library and the Digital Library Spirit is entirely collaborative. We've worked extensively on a cyber cemetery project a few years ago to digitally preserve with the government printing office. The political websites and different government websites having come out of a GovDocs department ourselves in the digital libraries area. That collaboration led to some digital preservations on our part. With Internet Archive and working with them. And then we have heavily worked with IIPC, just multiple preservation initiatives with the goal of developing tools and services that other groups can use so that even if we aren't necessarily maintaining some kind of information in our scope, someone else can use tools that we create in these collaborations and do that on their initiatives and their institutions. We can't do it all, and no one group can do it all, but we can all help each other with the tools.
I would suggest that we wrap up so we have time for questions.
You can answer those questions in 60 seconds.
All right.
Time. when we look at preserving online news, preserving news in general gives us an opportunity to understand changes in social values, public discourse, and human interaction. This is a really nice academic answer. The short answer is that we need to preserve news for reasons such as Billy Bush and Donald Trump. But that story coming out is a perfect example of what we learn when we are able to dig through and examine what is in archived web data. Another example would be to go back and look at whitehouse.gov and look at the reporting around George Bush in 2003 and look at the announcement of the end of combat operations and see if the White House changed that story from March to October. And you can actually see the change in combat operations, major combat operations, by looking at the archived web pages. So it's an unbelievably important tool for and of news. And hopefully that was under 60 seconds. I ask the audience a question. How many people in here are academics? How many people are journalists? How many people are librarians? Okay, it's really good. I'm just curious what mix of voices we have represented in the room.
And hackers. How many hackers?
Hackers, technologists.
We had a question over here. Are there any questions?
And I also went online using social media to keep track of what was going on. And one of the most relevant sources I found was Periscope live video. And it was archived for a 3-hour-long video. And I was wondering what kind of strategies are maybe helpful for something that is that I guess large in a format as opposed to a 40-character format.
Please repeat the question.
So, what are the issues in archiving long-form video and media-rich data versus 140 characters in Twitter? I wish I had an answer. I think everyone in the room wishes that we had a simple answer. It is relatively simple to gather the bitstream for 140 characters and commit those into a repository, and quite another beast entirely to try to gather all of the media file. The Document Now project is working to gather not only the Twitter data, but also linked data, the data that is linked from the tweet. So if it's linked to websites, links to YouTube videos, and that's what we can found just for the questions that you raised. So I would say I don't have an answer, but it's certainly something that is at the forefront of our research and our work. And I hope that we can report on that as the project progresses. I wonder if maybe
Jennifer Younger, this question I think is from Matt. You mentioned the need for a business model to present that to publishers. How do you respond to that?
When you say respond, what do you mean?
Well, okay. What I heard you to say was that the publishers, the people that you're working with to preserve their needs, are interested in what's the business model for them. And you present the social side of things, why this is important to do. Are you expecting to have answers?
Well, I'm saying right now the problem is there's not a business model for them.
Okay, so that
and we
needs
to
be
an argument that there
okay.
should be one.
Thank you.
I look at Twitter as an example, and I don't necessarily think it's a good one, but they have created a business model around selling their content. Obviously, that's not needed. We need a business model. We need to have an argument that we can come back at them with.
Thank you. And in a way, I should say, we have to represent our institution. So if it's an institutional initiative in one way, we can't necessarily change our initiative institutionally. So that's something hard to address at a mission level, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
What are the opportunities for bringing this more to the public sphere? So one of the things that I think of when I see the question that you have up right now in terms of what are the opportunities that are given to us to find news, news preservation to me is a lot like personal digital archiving. It's something that I can talk to my parents about and they get it. I talk to my friends about it and they get it. But how do you start to channel that energy and how much that also now with what you're talking about in the business space? for how archiving actually can be an enhancement of the newspaper rather than a control box.
Are we repeating the question?
Or the audience.
How do you channel the energy involved in surrounding, preserving this content? Because so many people understand it. And it is something that we need to work.
I think in part it's the same struggle we have with selling the case for web archiving in general. The technology is relatively new. Your research in the space is relatively new. Library experience in the space is relatively new. And as you start to have more success with web archives, using news archives, creating community archives, we're going to start to have more success stories. And those success stories become the showpieces that we can use to sell what we're doing. But this community is still nascent. Conferences like this are still nascent. We have a lot of work to do. Every night.
Have any of you been involved with legal cases with Twitter archive issues have been used? I was just doing some research on a stalking case, and they referred to Twitter with messaging that was used by defendants. Have any of you any experience or perspective?
Not sure. Everything we do is we're very careful that it's within the terms of the service of Twitter's platform. So we are collecting some within that framework. But I think you're pointing out, and I think that also is that like there are real people involved in this data that we're collecting, and there's a potential to say enlarge damage if you know if there's material in there that could be used maybe in time when we first collected it.
Yeah, so we've had similar issues. These questions came up in the as part of the advisory board around the ethical issues. What would we do as a repository of these Twitter data if the FBI came to us and said we want to get at your archive and we want to gather these data? For us, because the data that we're gathering are public data, we're sort of a secondary, we're down the chain. The first place where they would be going is Twitter, and we know that that's happening. In fact, the ACLU just started up a case against Twitter with these data. So this is a big concern. I think that we all, any of us who are gathering social media information, probably need to have good attorneys on hand, or at least work with our schools of law to help us to wade through these issues.
I'd like to, if you don't mind, go back to Matthew's question for a moment around the value of that. And I'm wondering, this may be something you have some perspective on as well, is if there are any opportunities with very local news organizations, like very local ones where maybe there's less of a market or sort of value for their news, and they might not have the wherewithal to do anything with that. That might be a place to start.
It's very resilient. Much of what we've done has been start with any newspaper who wants to work with us. And this is, I'm going back to 2007 and letting the dominoes fall. I work with a foundation that funds fully newspaper digitization projects serving populations under 12,000. They call themselves Talker Foundation. They say we serve rural public libraries. When I work with one community who gets a Talker Foundation grant and digitize the whole line of their newspaper, including digitally preserving their PDFs, the county next door starts calling me and saying, hey, we want to do this. We just heard of this. And I've been watching my geography because I do actually drive out to those cities in Texas, and Texas is a big state. It's bigger than I thought as I'm driving. I will watch them fall. The community next year will be right next door to one the year before. Of course, I've started now calling each neighbor and community and saying, well, so-and-so's about to apply. Do you want to apply? Because it's less driving for me. But it's very much a rhizomic model, and with the idea that eventually publishers who are interested will jump on board as well and get permission. These communities don't apply for these grants without their publishers backing, without some kind of written document saying that they're allowed to. And we have had a lot of large community newspapers as well getting this as a result. but it's been very gradual and very organic.
I wonder how you can build on that. I mean, because what you've got effectively, and this is part of the reason why I love what you're doing at the University of Texas, but you've got this little microcosm that shouldn't exist. I mean, by all practical, nobody would love to leave the University of Texas in this space. And in reality, it is the leader in this space. The big piece that I struggle with, and we talked about this in Charlotte, is about being in one call conference as well, and part of the new station that's now working with you guys. You know, how do you take these local examples and have them become a national model? Because there's this gap between what you're doing in Texas and what's possible in other states that isn't being replicated except in one or two places. You know, any ideas, and it's a big picture question, that how do we start to move from the fringes to the center, the methodology that you created?
And that's a question I would, that's
you
something.
Repeat the question, and this is going to have to be probably the wrap up.
How would you move from the model that is in a fairly, a geographically displaced location in the center, and grow and expand and support other initiatives? And that's something that when I began at UNT 6 years ago, it was not very small, but still very new. And I think we're all amazed by how much it's really grown and how much there's been interest. We had, I think it was 80,000 pages when I began, and it'll all take 5 million, and it'll be 6 years. So it's just people get on board and start to, the word is out, that's our next step. Because I feel like we're teenagers now in the evolution of a business. So I would love to talk to anybody about that.
All right, thank you. We're great to have you. Anna Kramer, Matt Weber, Laura Rubel, and Chris Freeland. Great panel. Peter Arnett was back there a minute ago. May I share this? When we were talking, he said, you know, I'm really enjoying this. It's more interesting than I thought. That's a high compliment. Peter Bodwell, from UCLA Libraries, going to introduce our next speaker. All right, thanks, Edward. By way of introduction, I'll tell a quick story. This happened about 5 years ago. I was a postdoctoral researcher and my supervisor, Dr. Bone, who's over there, mentioned to me that the library was getting involved in helping support a collection of television news that faculty in the communication studies department, particularly Professor Rowling and also Professor Francis Dean, we're working on. And my initial thought was, okay, I asked how, okay, so is it like 1,000 hours, maybe covering the midterm elections or the Arab Spring? We're going to have to catalog it, maybe find some way to index it, put it online. And Tom said, no, I think it's, about 200,000 hours. It's already indexed and already online. And I said, well, this is going to be a fun project to work on then. And indeed it has been. Because it's been we've been able to move from that point to do a lot more fun things. Professor Rowling will be speaking now. It has, until from 2010 until very recently, was the chair of UCLA's Department of Communication Studies, the recipient of the Goldsmith Book Prize, and also the Copenhagen Award for Effective Teaching with Technology, among other honors. And the main topic of his research is the communication of positive and negative political information. So please welcome.
So I'm talking about the Newscape project, which is put together by Professor Francis Keane. I got this picture in part because it is one of the rare pictures you'll find of Paul Rosenthal. It also has Francis. But you actually can see Francis live right there if you want to follow the picture. Francis has been the director of our Communication Studies Archive for several years. I was previously chair of our department, and I'm leading the analog portion of the collection, the digitization of our old analog collection, which was started by my predecessor as chair and the founder of the archive, Professor Paul Rosenthal. It's kind of interesting. This is a rare picture of Paul Rosenthal. Speaking of archival collections, I think I've only seen one other photo of him from the 70s, and he looked exactly the same. So infer from that what you will. The UCLA Library has been a big part of our collection, especially in recent years. They help support the collection, and they help host the collection. Huge amount of files are produced by this that they are, in fact, helping us host. And if you want to go and see the collection, I think you can even see the existing older collection now since you're on the UCLA domain at tvnews.library.ucla.edu, although you should pay attention to me instead, temporarily. You can do it like after that. Other supporters include UCLA's Chancellor, the Dean of Social Sciences, Arcadia Fund, Social Sciences Computing, the NSF, and some other funding organizations. So the collections we actually have our oldest collection dates to the 1950s. It was a collection of audio recordings of campus speakers. So when Hollywood celebrities or politicians or media figures would come to campus, my predecessor, Department of Speech, before we did the Department of Communication Studies, would go and record those events live, and we digitize those. And originally we were just going to post those on our website to celebrate our department's 40th anniversary. We ended up deciding to host them on YouTube, which has been an interesting experience. I say interesting in part because we've gotten a lot more traffic there than I would have thought was possible, and most of it is organic from YouTube. We haven't put any money in advertising. We don't promote this very much other than a few links on our website. But there are analytics they give us, so we've had over 7 million views, which is, 728,000 views, 7 million minutes. If you look here, by the way, that big spike was we had a speech by Martin Luther King he gave on campus that we posted on the 40th anniversary of that visit. They got picked up by local media and was a large part of the hits, but we also have a lot of other people just coming across a variety of speakers. As you might expect from YouTube, one of the issues we've had is the commenters on YouTube, notorious commenters, and we have campus speakers that used to be more, we'll just say, diverse than they are in the modern era, including, it was common to have the founding American Nazi Party come and speak to college campus in the 1960s, which leads to commentaries online that you would expect. And we have the founding American Nazi Party on the video. So things like that have been a problem, and we have had some copyright issues, some of which we've been able to resolve by pointing out to the organization that, in fact, this is a UCLA speaker on a UCLA campus who's employed by UCLA while they're speaking. So you might be violating our copyright. Situations like that are kind of fun. The Musescape project, though, is most of what I'll be talking about today. It's the largest collection we have, and it basically was intended to be TV news and public affairs programming, both local and national. It was started during the Watergate era. As you heard previously, the people of Vanderbilt were doing an excellent job cataloging the three major evening newscasts since the 1960s. But during the Watergate hearings, it was clear to Professor Rosenthal that there was a lot of TV information that was civically consequential that was just being lost. So local news was one example, but these hearings, if you're just collecting the three major evening newscasts, you're losing a lot of raw information. So using a very, very thin budget, $10,000 a year, plus volunteer labor and donated equipment, it grew to become, in 1979, a recording of all the local news and national news one would see if one lived in Los Angeles and had a television. So it was intended to be a complete collection, not of necessarily every local news, but at least local news in LA, and then all the national news, not just the evening newscast. 2006, Francis led the effort to go straight to digital, so you talk about born digital recording. That's when we really started taking things off of the videotapes and instead recording on hard drives. And since 2006, we've expanded the collection to cover a lot of the city. So I'll tell you basically what we have prior to 2006, though. We don't really kind of know what we have. It's kind of spread over multiple organizations. You can imagine the volume of videotapes that we're talking about here. You might have a sense of exactly how disastrous that is. My department has changed offices four times since I've been here, since 2001. and each time something else has gotten sort of moved someplace else, we're still not sure what we have. There's good records for some portions, but basically Paul's leap in some sense was, I'm going to record everything I can, and then someone in the future will take care of it. It's important to save it, and that's exactly right, if you have limited resources, but now we're the people out there to figure out what's actually on the tape. So there's also issues with, you know, we get the tape, and it kind of know what should be on the tape, and then it's preempted by a football game, or someone actually lost power and didn't know it on the VCR, or something like that. So we won't really know what we have until we're done. It's kind of fun. So the tapes, earliest ones, actually we have some reel-to-reel, and I don't know what to do with those, but we have about 500 pneumatic tapes. We have about 50,000 hours on Betamax, which I'm not looking forward to at all. And then we have late period that we're focusing on now, about 160,000 hours on VHS with some redundancy, where we have duplicate recordings for that time period, and that's going to take a little while. So the preservation, we actually are starting first with the VHS because they're the most threatened. The VHS, ironically, even though they're newer, were recorded during a period where cable TV expansion and also some budget issues meant that we were cramming 8 hours of recording on consumer-grade tapes and consumer-grade recording equipment. So in contrast to, actually, Betamax was better, I think, in some sense, as a recording medium, as you might have heard from other people. Those are holding up really well. Pneumatic was professional-grade equipment, very expensive, high-quality tapes. So those are holding up well, but our consumer-grade VHS stuff is really quite great. So we're currently working to pull things off of there, and we also are finding things like, oh, that VCR was failing for quite a while before they recognized it and took it out of service. So we have things that are kind of out of adjustment. And you know, up until literally this month, even our faculty offices in my department didn't have air conditioning. So our tapes didn't have air conditioning for a long period of time. They got it before we did. So that's one of our priorities. The cost to digitize, even the VHS collection, I got an estimate from another archive that shall remain nameless that has, they showed me a fancy robotic loading system and these really nice high quality VCR. They quoted me a price of $10 an hour, which I'll let you do the math, but we don't have that kind of money. It's a short answer. So we are doing it on a shoestring. We are spent a total of $20,000 on equipment for a lab that is currently processing tapes at the rate of around 320 hours per day. So we're cranking through it as best we can. I'll go through the system that we're using. And it's basically run by me, and I'm not teaching or researching or serving on endless committees, which seems to happen a lot. And I have one part-time alumnus who is in a paid position temporarily, and then work study students. And then Francis handles the files after that I've reflected. And switching to Betamax, I am really dreading, because I don't know if you've gone on eBay recently. Betamax VCRs are expensive and sell them. So our lab currently, we have 22 digitization stations, basically which are a VCR, an encoder, and a computer. And we have local RAID storage that we use to temporarily hold the files, and we use FileMaker as our data solution to manage the information about the files and other data. Basically, it's nice that we're using really cheap computers. You don't actually need, if you have hardware encoders, typically good computers, and we do not have good computers. We have very bad computers. I think some of the ones we got off of eBay were used in like one laptop for child school situations and dropped repeatedly and stuff, but they still work. So we're using hardware encoders. We're going to MPEG-2 initially, in part because we have trouble finding MPEG-4 encoders that will maintain closed captioning. And the closed captioning is a vital part of our indexing scheme, so that we can know we could get that up. If you care, JVC, SVHS, VCR seem to be the best ones for us after testing. And actually, consumer-grade ones, because we found that some of the professional decks weren't very good at these super long playbacks that they just weren't designed for. They didn't really expect people to be using those pro machines for extremely consuming long tape. So anyway, we actually then use FileMaker and you know, simple barcodes and have the students use their cell phones through our inventory system using barcode pictures with their phones. It actually works out pretty well in the equipment for that. And we use the Hoffman cluster here on campus to extract the closed captioning and compress the files to H.264 to run into that. So, progress to date, we just started, this was one of my final priorities when I was chair, was to deal with this huge backlog of tapes we haven't dealt with. So I started that process in fall 2015, did some configuration testing, and we started working on this in winter 2016 and ramped up. New file maker in summer, and so basically we've done about 36,000 hours of encoding so far this year. And there's a step in the process that I'm dreading, which is going back and figuring out, based on the very limited information we have about each tape, what the individual shows are, splitting them up and dating, and getting the time on them set correctly, which is nice. Anyway, we'll deal with that later. So lots of other problems in this process. The original VCRs and recording aids were overworked and very cheap and gradually got further and further out of spec. The nice way we talk about that is to say they had personalities, very strong personalities. And so what we ended up having to do, and the VCRs that we bought also have personalities. And actually, if you find compatible personalities, they play back really well. And if you don't, they play back really poorly. So we had to, over time, do some testing and figure out which of our VCRs were most like Paul's original VCRs and find that love connection. Have lots of issues, actually, that librarians hopefully can help us with about how to handle the changing names of shows or the same time, same host, but different names of the same show or not. You know, that sort of information is going to be kind of difficult. We have issues like, oh, why are we getting audio buzzing? It's when you put a computer directly on top of a VCR, you get RF in here. So we're actually using a layer of dead VCRs to protect our good VCRs. And you have lots of other problems. If you like and give me some alcohol, I'll give you a lot of problems. But most of our problems, if it's a problem, we talk about the quality and try again as best we can. And some of the ones we're just frankly not going to be able to recover because nothing is ever recorded or such. The digital collection is actually, I think, much more interesting potentially for this group because it is going straight to digital and includes a lot of material that starts off as digital material. Right now we're covering 46 networks in the US and beyond. You know, over 2,000 series. I would say, actually, this is data from a month ago. Francis could probably update this. We're nearly probably up to 400,000 video files, over 300,000 hours in duration by this point. Closed caption files are a big part of our index. We use them to basically find material based on text. We're also doing optical character recognition of all of our files, which is very helpful for knowing the topic that's being talked about across a long period of time and also other things that's happening at that time. Useful also for separating out commercials. So we also do thumbnail images periodically so you can visually search our collection and find things, even if there's not closed captioning for a particular show in it. And again, we have access there using a search engine the library has helped us set up. In terms of unlocking the content, we view preservation as the first step, and we don't really want this thing to necessarily be the world's best DVR. Part of what we see as our value added here, especially as an academic department involved in this, is helping provide the tools to help people understand and interpret this data as opposed to just watching the shows again. And also, we'd like them to be able to find and share. So, for instance, it's good to know if you search for Barack Obama or Obama, well, there's 155,000 videos or so. I will watch all 155,000. No, you're not going to watch all 155,000 videos of Barack Obama. It's useful to know, you know, tools and see the coverage over time and visualize patterns of news and see the forest, not just the trees. So we're working on some things. This is a quick example of visualizing where candidates were getting news coverage, what the terms were that were associated with them, which candidates got more or less coverage over the course of the 2012 election. I should admit to one of my colleagues, Junshul Ju, who is not here today, has been helping develop some of these tools as well. This is another one he had. That CNN is on the bottom of the axis, Fox is in the upper right-hand corner, MSNBC is in the top left corner. You might not be able to read the terms very carefully, but this is over the process of the time period where the Affordable Care Act is being debated in Congress. And you can see over time what issues some channels talk about more than others, or terms some networks talk about more than others, change gradually. So, interestingly, MSNBC tends to talk about Republican members of Congress more. You see Fox talks about Democratic members of Congress more in their coverage and talks about things like trillion, mandate, rec, premium, subsidy exchange, implement. And, you know, CNN's talking about Angie for some reason, I don't know, ceiling, negotiate, default, shut down debt. And MSNBC is talking about continuing resolution, Ted Cruz, repeal, and some of these. So, again, you can see how the pattern shift over time. You can start seeing that as it's actually introduced, you start seeing the navigator being talked about on Fox, canceled, deductibles, things like that. So seeing those patterns over time is, I think, probably more useful than having necessarily people be able to see the individual videos that went into generating them. So developing those tools is part of our mission. We also have been trying to help people analyze visuals. This is, again, an area my department is trying to build expertise in. We already have the ability to recognize named entities in the collection, parts of speech, and topic collection, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Sentiment is a little bit harder in the text, and visuals are challenging, but we're doing things like facial detection and facial analysis and being able to scale those more and more over time. So, for instance, we can potentially understand patterns in news and do it with automated coding and be less subject to subjectivity than if humans do it, building on machine learning and big data tools. We're very excited by that. We presented a paper at this year's American Political Science Association convention, and we're doing things like looking at presidential candidates, locating their faces, and then looking at how often they're shown smiling versus not smiling in the news over three election cycles. And, you know, you can find a little face validity joke here. We're generating a score of how much they're smiling based on this, and then putting a cut point of higher than that level of confidence they're smiling. If you have any curiosity, actually, Hillary Clinton was smiling a lot more this election cycle than Donald Trump. I'll just leave that word. We also have a site that you might be interested in, viz2016.com, viz with a Z, where we have set up some interactive tools based on both Twitter and our collection to look at, you know, how much coverage different candidates got, the sentiment, at least on Twitter, some of that coverage, and have done some topic tracking tools. Again, we're pretty excited about this tool. We're able to see in both individual channels or more broadly what the topics are that different news organizations focus on and how those topics evolve over time, who the main figures are that are associated with them, and what those topics are and where they're located. So that's, I think, in the broader collection, going to be a very fast and accessible tool to see these changes over time. We also have done another version that's interactive, where you can do that same sort of triangle try to show you earlier, but just focusing on presidential candidates that you select or news organizations you select to show their coverage of this is Donald Trump for the month of June, and looking at what Fox versus CNN versus MSNBC tend to be covering. For some reason, CNN did a lot more stories talking about Mexicans than Donald Trump than other channels on MSNBC. You go to the equivalent of Hillary Clinton, this one dot way over by Fox is talking about her emails. So you can see patterns that maybe you have intuitively and then over time as well. We'd also like to, although we haven't developed these tools yet, help people potentially share what they find in the collection. Again, copyright might constrain that, but we'd like to do things that are within that boundary. So one thing is, of course, sharing this type of analysis I've talked about, but also we'd like for people to use familiar copyright compliant tools to create their own sort of exhibits and share those. One of the social sharing tools you might be familiar with is to do animated GIF generation. So short clips, small files have the on-screen captioning, so people could share a portion of news in social media in a compact file format and then be able to have the text embedded in it. And the other is supercut generators, taking fair use compliant clips from multiple sources, assembling them into a single exhibit that would be transformative and sharing that online. Again, we're fairly early in the development of those tools, but that is something we think is a nice use of this collection. So, we have preservation of the gold, and we're also starting with preservation. We would like to see this collection be one of those clear tools for understanding big picture changes in media over time. I think we all realize there have been huge changes in the news media over the time period we cover, and I think we're trying to study that. We would appreciate any advice or funding leads you have to help us do this collection. Again, we're doing this very efficiently, but it would be nice to have more money. And that, again, the beta just scares me. $400 for a really terrible VCR these days is working. So that's all I have for today. Questions? How are you?
The Council on Library and Information Resources just announced they've gotten $2.75 million from Mellon for preservation of audiovisual material.
You taking notes?
Call up.
Say, who is that again?
The Council, or CLIR, the Council on Library and Information.
Already a good question.
I'm curious about the manual kind of metadata work that goes into this for the entire collection. So you're doing a lot of stuff, obviously, for these directives digital. You can automate more of those things.
Sure.
But I'm just curious to what extent, kind of, for example, when a student comes in and puts in, you know, the tape, how much time do they have to spend on each tape and each recording? And
so this is the other reason why I'm terrified of the Betamaxes, is those are 3 hours or fewer tapes. Right now, the nice thing about the VHS is we're relatively low labor, because the students will come in and start the recording process and enter the metadata we have for that particular tape and make sure everything is working relatively well and neat. And then we have the lab unsupervised while all 22 machines are encoding, and then another student comes in at the end of 8 or 9 hours to make sure that the files are exported correctly, the information is set, and it's on the server, and does a quality control check that either makes us know we have to do this tape again because it didn't work right, or sends it on the process of Francis to process it. So that process is actually relatively straightforward. I mentioned we haven't actually done the step of slicing up the shows into individual portions. That's in part because our collection is not currently well ordered in chronological order, and we only know with some gaps what's supposed to be on some of the tapes. We don't know what's supposed to be on most of these tapes. We just know the only information that's on the tapes themselves for this period of time is the date that it was pulled from the VCR, so that doesn't even tell you what the programming is, and the VCR number it came from. Normally, they follow a regular program, and some of them are very regular. Like, there's a CNN for multiple hours per day that just is that. And as long as CNN doesn't change the name of the shows, which they seem to do constantly, just constantly, then we can know what that is as long as we know the day it came out of the VCR. But there are other ones where there's breaking news or other events where we actually don't know what's on the tape until we view it. And the plan is to get everything from that sort of time period encoded and start looking back in time, taking advantage of the similarity in the same VCR over time, and also resources like archived TV guides and such to try to figure out what's on each tape. But that is something that, actually, the plan is to involve our alumni and crowdsource that online and have people who are retired and knowledgeable about news and very generous with their time help us by cutting the split points and identifying the shows online using a custom program we're setting up. But that's still down the road as well.
Last question?
Yeah, with the cost issue you already noted, has there been any discussion about training to repair what you have to help offset that cost?
So, actually, one of our WorkSpace students is interested in learning VCR repair, which is like what you see on late night TV ads. he's interested, but we're fortunate. One of the reasons why I selected JVC is that was what the campus classroom VCRs were set to, and we were able to find somebody who's still employed at UCLA who has expertise in repairing JVC VCRs, who's given us a great big break for doing that. So that's been a very useful arrangement. I guess that was the last question.
UCLA Communications Department, in this case, really excellent project. It is now lunchtime, but as I warned you before, we have another task for you before you get your food, and that is you're going to vote for the one kind of content. I've got five choices, so this is decidedly non-scientific, but hopefully still fun. I guess if you were on a desert island and you only had one kind of content, or maybe that's not even that, maybe it's we're 100 years from now, what format of content, if you had to choose one, just one, text, photos, audio, video, or something else, which one of those would be most important for us to say to archive? So, let's rejoice as a bowl, take one ticket. You only get one vote. Then, You may proceed out the door, down the hallway, out the front of the library, and you will see a patio, basically on that same